I apologize. There was supposed to be extra orders. There was a miscommunication. That's why I had the just the tears.
All right. So I was told that I'm not going to be granted any more extensions for filing this year. It's time to finally get around to the shiur about paying taxes in Halakha. It's especially appropriate, I guess, today is Memorial Day. So it's a national holiday in which we celebrate the contributions of the armed forces, and certainly our taxes that we pay go towards helping to strengthen the defense and other services that are provided in the country. And there's a sense of appreciation for what this country provides. Rav Moshe Feinstein refers to the United States as a Malchus Shel Chesed. So I just want to preface the discussion by making it clear that we believe that this is fundamentally a good country that's been particularly good for the Jewish people over the centuries. And when we speak about this topic, it's not really for the purpose of trying to figure out how to evade paying taxes per se. Although, obviously, anybody who is involved with the filing tax returns year to year, it's a normal thing to not want to be hit with too much of a tax burden, and that's also part of the American way to figure out how to take advantage of good legal loopholes, as the case may be. But it's a tricky topic in general, in part because of the fact that not all of the sources are so comfortable. Meaning that if somebody starts off with the strong position that, well, of course you pay taxes because that's the American way, that's the moral and ethical and proper thing to do. So you'll find in some of the sources suggestions of perhaps there not being a categorical obligation in every single case, and that might be somewhat jarring depending on one's perspective. And from the other standpoint, if somebody begins with the perspective that, well, of course, we have to figure out how to chisel the government or any government in any which way that we can, so you might be upset by some of the Mekoros that take a very strong stand about the obligation to pay taxes. But I just want to go into the sugya really with an open mind and just with an objective analysis of how to understand some of the nuances. So it starts off really with the sugya in Baba Kama, and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel. The Gemara there begins with the assumption that you shouldn't take any money, even to change a large coin for smaller coins, from somebody who's a tax collector, because there's a chazaka that if somebody's a tax collector, then he's probably a crook. That's the assumption. It used to be that people would purchase the concession from the government, that they would have the right to collect taxes, and they would sometimes collect too much taxes, and sometimes they weren't legitimate altogether, and therefore there was always the suspicion of somebody who would be the local tax collector that this was, unlike a person who's a gabbai, obviously, who's considered to be amongst the most upstanding member of the community, but somebody who's a tax collector, okay, so we're suspicious of their bona fides, and therefore they're assumed to be a crook. So Shmuel cooking up something, that's
cooking the books.
So cooking the books. Thank you. So Shmuel is quoted by the Gemara as saying, "Wait a second. Why is it that we are so suspicious of tax collectors?" Shmuel dina de machusadina. Didn't Shmuel say that the law of the land is the law? This is a principle articulated by Shmuel in a number of different places in the Gemara. The Meiri, Maseches Nedarim, elsewhere, points out that it's a Shmuel the Shitoso, because you have a machlokus between Rav and Shmuel in the Gemara in Sanhedrin about whether everything that was enunciated by Shmuel Hanavi when the people asked for a melech, they asked to have a king during the days of Shmuel, and Shmuel said, "What, you don't like me?" He was very insulted that they were asking for a king, and he told them, he said, "Zeyeh mishpat ha-melech." He said, "What the mishpat ha-melech is going to be, and this is these are all the rights and prerogatives that a king has," and he was trying to scare them off. that they shouldn't want a king, because a king is going to conscript their children into the army, a king is going to take their properties, they can exercise the eminent domain. So he was explaining all the different things that a king can do, and amongst the things that a king can do, a king is allowed, Sonchem Yasir, has the right to collect taxes, to take certain tithes and taxes from the people. And there's a machlokus whether Shmuel HaNavi was only looking to frighten the people, but really not everything that was in this Mishpat HaMelech is something which is Melech Mutavo, is something which a king is really allowed to do, or whether we say, no, the king is really allowed to do all of those things. So the Rav said, the Amora said, Lo nema parshizu ala ayim aleim. It's source 11 here. Rav said it's only in the Sanhedrin da Chufim and Beis. He only said all these things to frighten them and to make them scared. And Shmuel said, no, kula amo beparshas melech, melech mutabo. Anything which is in the parshas melech that's described by Shmuel HaNavi and Shmuel Aleph Perites, all of those things that the Shmuel HaNavi said that a king could do, a king really has the right to do. So the Meiri says that when Shmuel says, dina de machus adina, Shmuel ashitaso. The Shmuel said that that which Shmuel HaNavi had articulated, that a melech has the right to do, including the collection of taxes, is something that a king really does have the prerogative to do. So that is the basis. That is the basis on some fundamental level for this principle of dina de malchus adina, that if somebody is appointed as the king over the land, the king has the right to collect taxes. That's a part of the authority. That's part of the jurisdiction of the king. So if so, so why are we so down on tax collectors? They're just collecting that which the king has the right to collect. So why do we assume that they're all a bunch of thieves? So there are two different answers that are initially given by the Gemara. One is that we're talking about a muchas or she'eno kitzvah, a tax collector who buys the concession to collect taxes, but rather than being told, oh, you taxation for this population is supposed to be 1,000 rubles, you collect your 1,000 rubles and move on, you can just collect whatever amount he wants to collect, and can collect whatever is going to fill up his pockets, and it's not legitimate. He's collecting more than he really is entitled to collect. So that's the type of illegitimate tax collector that we're referring to. And Debei Rabbi Yanai Amar, Amri Memuchas Omei Me'elov. We're talking about a Muchas, a tax collector who's not appointed by the king, not appointed by the governor, just somebody who's a mafioso, who shows up and wants protection money, and is collecting from various people without being an emissary of the government. So that person is clearly illegitimate. So after the Gemara has this whole discussion, and brings a number of different contexts in which this same discussion appears, like for example in the Gemara Nedarim, talks about how a person is allowed to sort of, kind of lie to a tax collector, not really lie, but take a nether which is misleading, a misleading nether, which the person says, oh, these assets really already belong to the king, so they're not subject to taxation, or they're truma, they're holy sanctified assets, and it's not really entirely true. But what they're really saying is, oh, I won't be able to eat today, or eat, you know, any food today in the event these assets don't really belong to the king, or aren't really truma assets. And he says that I'm going to prohibit food to myself forever. It sounds like he says I'm going to prohibit food to myself. And he's thinking in his head, I mean today. I'm not going to eat this food today, but tomorrow I'll be allowed to eat the food. So that kind of a ruse when it comes to sort of like a misleading statement that's being made to the tax collector would not be something that we would normally permit. But we permit that type of a ruse when we're dealing with an illegitimate tax collector. And again, we give the same in the Gemara in the Nedarim, the Chof Chesem and Aleph, that's quoted here in the Gemara in Bava Kamma. We give the same explanations that we're dealing either with a tax collector who's collecting more than his fair share, or we're talking about a tax collector who simply was self-appointed and is not a representative of the government. And then you have a statement of Rav Ashi, about 10 lines down in the Gemara, in source 1, and Rav Ashi makes a statement which creates a lot of confusion in terms of exactly what the implications, the long range implications of the principle are going to be. Because if I only have the first two answers, so most of the time that you're paying your taxes, presumably you're not paying your taxes to a gangster. If you are, so, you know, we have other problems to deal with, but that's not what we mean when you fill out your tax form. So some people might say, oh, the government, they're a bunch of gangsters. but they're not halakhically considered to be a bunch of gangsters. Belvila Soloveitchik considered the entire the communist regime that he lived under, I guess, in Russia, he considered that to be a gang of gangsters. He considered that to be a band of gangsters, and he didn't think that the principle of Dina de Malchusa would apply to that government. He thought that was more of a Kamsanusa de Malchusa. It wasn't like a real government. It was a government which made up of a robbery and a discrimination and unfair laws. So he felt that that wasn't really a binding per se. But here we're living in a democratic government. We are based on other types of governments where Chazal assumed that we would apply the principle of Dina de Malchusa, that it was considered to be fair enough. So certainly the government here that Rav Moshe Feinstein describes as a Malchusa Shel Chesed doesn't just wantonly and randomly, you know, put people in jail and extort people for money and so forth. So we would consider this to be a legitimate government, and then clearly there would be an obligation to pay taxes. But Rav Ashi says that there's another exclusion. What's the exclusion, Rav Ashi? Rav Ashi says b'muchas kanani. If you have a tax collector who's a kanani, now some have the girsa of a kanani onus, a strong-armed kanani, a strong-armed non-Jewish person who's kind of like a little bit of a highway robber. But that's not the simple girsa. The simple girsa seems to be that we're talking about a regular muchas kanani who is simply an idolater, a non-Jew. So why suddenly do you not have to pay if he happens to be a non-Jew? So the Gemara explains, Ditanya. There's a long discussion, digression in the Gemara. It says, Ditanya, we have a brisa, that whenever you have a Jew and a non-Jew who come for a Din Torah, so then, again, we're talking about idolaters, but, you know, nonetheless, the Gemara says that if you can win the case according to the Jewish law, so you apply Jewish law. If you can win the case according to the non-Jewish law, you apply non-Jewish law. When the Rambam codifies this halacha, he says this doesn't apply to somebody who's a ger tosha, somebody who is moved away from your kind of old-time barbaric type of idolater, but a person who accepts officially the seven Noahide laws, then we would just apply their legal system, and we wouldn't say that it's dependent upon whichever system is going to work best for us. And then there's a continuation of the Gemara afterwards, in which Rabbi Akiva indicates that if you can't emerge victorious based on either our legal system or the non-Jewish legal system, so then if it would be a Kiddush Hashem to simply follow whatever the law is going to be, you follow whatever the law is going to be, even if it's against you. But he says that if you can figure out some other ruse to get them to win the case, or to rule in favor of the Jewish party, so then you figure out some other ruse to do it. So then that sounds like it's okay to just steal from them, because if you don't have a right to rule in favor of the Jewish party, either according to Jewish law or non-Jewish law, so then what's going on according to Rabbi Akiva? So the Gemara says, V'gezel k'nayni mishari, are you allowed to steal from non-Jews? So don't worry, the answer is no, you're not allowed to steal from non-Jews. That's the conclusion of the Gemara. So we have a little bit, and in fact, Rabbi Akiva himself says that. So how do we resolve the stira, this internal contradiction within Rabbi Akiva? So we have at the end of the Gemara, we say, no problem, kan begezelo v'kan behafkos hava also. That you're not allowed to steal from a non-Jew, but let's say a non-Jew loaned you some money, and you owe them the money, and you just get around, you know, you never get around to repaying the money. You never get around to repaying the money. That's okay. That's called hafkas havaaso. You're not stealing outright. You borrowed some money and you never ended up repaying the money. So that's what Rabbi Akiva says. Rabbi Akiva indicates that if there would be like a Kiddush Hashem or Chilul Hashem consideration, so then you don't rely upon this type of consideration, upon this type of a heter, but otherwise you would have a heter. That's what the Gemara says. Time adika Kiddush Hashem, haleka Kiddush Hashem, then buy in Allah bakifin, so then you figure out a way not to pay your obligations when dealing with non-Jews, and that would seem to be the maskana of the Gemara. Now, if you look in the Rambam, take the question in a moment, because I feel it's important to state this. The Rambam says you're not allowed to be gozel from a non-Jew. You're also not allowed to be ma'ashko. You're not allowed to commit oshik. What is oshik according to the definition of the Rambam? The definition of the Rambam of oshik is you borrow money from somebody and then you simply, you know, never repay it. The person asks for the money. I'm not repaying the money right now. Ask me tomorrow, whatever. He's just not paying the money. So the Rambam never says explicitly anywhere in his writings that, and he talks a lot about, you know, all of your obligations towards Jews, non-Jews, and so forth when it comes to laws of theft. He never says that hafkas havaaso, that failing to repay a loan or an obligation to a non-Jew is permitted. He never says that. So the Netziv, in his Rav Naftali Tzvi Berlin, in his commentary to the Gemara, he has a commentary to the Gemara, which is known as Merome Sada. So in his commentary to this passage right here that we're learning in Baba Kama, he points out that the Rambam does not codify this maskana of the Gemara of Akan Begzelo, Akan Behafkas Haba'aso, that Hafkas Milve would be permitted by a non-Jew, because the Rambam doesn't hold that way. According to the Rambam, this is not Halacha L'maisa. Well, if it's not Halacha L'maisa, so then the whole case of Mukhas Knani, where we're saying, oh, it's okay to not take a non-Jewish tax collector seriously, because Hafkas Haba'aso, if you're just not paying an obligation, you're not paying what presumably would be owed to them, so that would be okay. So according to the Rambam, that really shouldn't be codified. But when the Rambam does codify the various types of tax collectors whom you're allowed to ignore or whom you assume are Ganavim and so forth, so the Rambam does include the answer of Rav Ashi. So it could be that this is what the Vilna Gaon suggests within the Rambam, that the Rambam has a different girsa in the Gemara. Like, we have about four lines before the end of the first paragraph. It says, Ditanya. Ditanya means that this whole discussion in the Gemara regarding whether you're allowed to steal from a non-Jew, the answer is no. Whether you're allowed to simply not be paying an obligation, the answer seems to be yes. That's called Hafkas Haba'aso. It's a continuation or an explanation of Rav Ashi saying, oh, b'muchas kanani. If the tax collector is a kanani, is a non-Jew, so then you don't have the same obligation to pay. So it says Ditanya, because after all we have the following brisa, and then at the end of the brisa it's explaining that Hafkas Havaso is okay. But according to the Vilna Gaon, the dalet is missing in the Girsa of the Rambam, that there's a period, Menuchas Kanani period, and then Tanya, and then a new paragraph, new discussion. We have a brisa in which we're reconciling two apparently contradictory statements of Rabbi Akiva, and we're able to reconcile Rabbi Akiva by saying, yes, according to Rabbi Akiva, Gezel Akum, stealing outright from a non-Jew, is not allowed, but Hafkas Havaso is okay. But that has nothing to do with the Halacha L'maisa, what Rav Ashi is talking about. What then is Rav Ashi talking about? Menuchas Kanani? Menuchas Kanani could just be that there's a presumption that if the tax collector, like if the tax collector is a Jewish fellow, and you know that this person is collecting more than what they're supposed to, what they're entitled to, so then you're not obligated to pay your taxes. With a non-Jew, you don't have to research it. You don't have to investigate. If it's a non-Jewish tax collector, you can assume that he's up to no good. You can assume that he's a gazlan. That's all that it means. You can assume that any non-Jew is going to have this tax concession, that they have the right to collect the tax, they're collecting more than they're entitled to collect, and that's why you don't have to pay them. And not that there's necessarily a heter of hafkas haba'aso. This is very important. According to the Rambam, the only thing that would be permitted, strictly speaking, according to the maskan of the Gemara, that's the last paragraph of the Gemara, would be if I have an aveda, if I have a lost article. So there we have a special halacha, that we have special favors that we do to members of our close-knit community, the Jewish community, that let's say, according to non-Jewish law, you know, we say finders, keepers, losers, weepers. Let's say there would be such a principle in non-Jewish law that there would be no obligation to return lost objects. Then we say we don't have to be more proactive in returning lost objects to the non-Jews than their own laws require. But our laws require that at least with respect to Jewish compatriots, we do have to return lost objects. So there's a special exception when it comes to lost objects. Also a toast. Let's say you go to the store and you give some money for your groceries, and they give you back more change than what you're entitled to. So they gave you the change. Now you look at the change and you discover they made a toast. You didn't deliberately mislead them. A toast, so to deliberately mislead them would be wrong. But they made a toast. So the Gemara says, well, toast, Akum, if they mistakenly made, you know, an error in giving you too much change, so then you're not obligated to point it out to them. So that would survive. Even according to the Rambam, that would survive the maskan of the Gemara. But the notion that you're going to refuse to pay back a loan, of course, Havaso, that wouldn't survive according to the Rambam. But that's just the Rambam. If you don't hold like the Rambam, then that does it then, and then you say, Ditanya, then it seems that if I have a non-Jew who's the tax collector, maybe even if it's the non-Jew who's the tax-imposing authority, that I would have this potential exception, right? That you wouldn't have to actually pay your taxes Under those circumstances, maybe that's a possible way. I'm not saying that's the maskan. I'm not saying that's the way that we're going to interpret the Gemara. I'm saying if you would have an argument maybe to interpret the Gemara that way. In fact, you would especially have such an argument if you take a look at the way that Rashi explains b'hafkas ha'ba'aso, because Rashi seems to hold like the Ditanya approach, that this whole discussion in the Gemara is really a continuation of this case that Ravashi spoke about, where you don't have to worry about the tax collector or take him seriously. That Ravashi said, the Muchas Kanani, and then at the very conclusion of the Gemara, where we say, well, you can't steal outright from a non-Jew, right? But if it's Behafkas HaVaso, that's okay. She'en Gezel Mamish, because that's not actually stealing, and it's not Mamish stealing. You're not going into his property and plucking out somebody else's, you know, taxes that they pay. You're just not paying your own. You're not filing your own tax return. You know, how many times have you, you know, spoken to somebody who, like, you know, proudly brags, oh, I haven't filed a tax return in 20 years. I don't know if you've had, I've had, like, in the dinner conversations like this with people, like, you know, so you just, you don't know what to do. You don't understand. Oh, well, you know, I hope you don't get caught. I don't know what to say, you know, but, so that sounds like hafkas ha'ba'aso. So Rashi says, she'ein gezel mamish. That's not, you know, actual stealing. As long as, as Larry says, as long as there's no Chilul Hashem. That was basically what Rabbi Akiva had said in the court case scenario. Well, if there's a Kiddush Hashem to be made by following, you know, the strict law and not figuring out, you know, a way to weasel out of the obligation for the Jew to pay the non-Jew, so then you go with that. But obviously, if you're creating a Kiddush Hashem, which most of the time, hopefully you would be, and certainly, if you would otherwise create a Chilul Hashem, it's going to be a front page newspaper headline, the New York Times, saying that, you know, this Jewish person made off with, you know, billions of dollars or something, so that they stole. So, you know, that's going to create a terrible, you know, Chilul Hashem. Then this dispensation wouldn't apply. But what are the next words in Rashi? Next words in Rashi says, L'avriach ha-meches ha-begevkos ha-ba'aso. That sounds pretty good for those who want to avoid paying taxes. He says, oh, and l'avriach ha-meches, to avoid paying taxes, well, that's a manifestation and an application of hafkas ha-ba'aso, of simply getting around not paying off your debts. How does the Rambam codify the halakha? It's very interesting. So I quoted the Nitziv, I was saying that the Rambam never says anywhere that hafkas ha-ba'aso is mutter. He seems to hold that it's also because oshek is also when it comes to non-Jews. But nonetheless, he does list all these three exceptions. When he says, that we assume that the tax collector is a ganav, you're not allowed to change your money with their money and so forth. Shemuchas kalistim, bisman shemuchas goy. So he starts off, that's the first case. Yes, Ravashi is the first case. If the muchas is a goy, he doesn't say a goy anas, he says not a strong-armed gangster goy, any goy. Or muchas ome melav, or he just appointed himself as the tax collector, that's more the mafia case. Or muchas ome machmas melach, or he was legitimately appointed by the kingdom, however, vein lo kitzvah, but there's no set amount, and he just can collect as much as he wants to feed his pockets, so then you're not obligated to give him. Lokeach mashiyirtze, meniach mashiyirtze, he decides that he's going to collect as much as he wants. Aval, but if you have a legitimate tax collector, he's supposed to collect a set amount, and he gets a cut. That's the way it would work with the tax concessions. They were told to collect a certain amount that was owed by the population, and the tax collector would get a certain percentage for their work. And the tax collector happened to be a Jewish tax collector, because the Rambam already said if he was a non-Jewish tax collector, so then you don't have to pay him. But if he's a Jewish tax collector, and you know that this person is neman, that they are credible and trustworthy, they're not going to be an emo kitzur situation where they're adding on more money than what they were authorized to collect. They're not considered to be a gazlan. Why is that? Because the king is entitled to collect his taxes. Below, oh, and then the Rambam goes further, and this is a very important line in the Rambam, how you interpret and understand this line. Meaning, even if the person is not grabbing money from the king's treasury, okay, they're not breaking into the United States Mint and stealing money, but they're simply holding on to their money and not paying it to a legitimate tax collector, the Rambam says that is a case of gozel. That's a case of outright stealing. It's a very interesting law. Why is it outright stealing? It's outright stealing. Why? Because he is stealing the portion of money, even though it's portion of his money maybe he earned, you know, from his own work, from his own assets, from his own crops, whatever the case may be. No! This is the portion that belongs to the king. By holding it for himself or herself, it's considered as if he has actually stolen that which belongs to the king. So you say, oh, well, maybe that's only if it's a Jewish king. No. So the Rambam says, Bein Shayamel Goy, whether the king was a non-Jew, Bein Shayamel Yisrael, or whether the king was Jewish. The funny thing about this Rambam is that the Chiddush, that the later authorities had to point out, like the Beis Yosef, for example, is that you might think that this would only be true if the Melech was a goy. If the Melech was a non-Jew, so you say, okay, so non-Jewish kings have a certain right based on this idea of Dina de Malchusa, but maybe Jewish kings, a Jewish king, where would there be a difference, a reason to differentiate between a Jewish king and a non-Jewish king? In a standard country, who cares? Whoever is the king is the king. They happen to be Jewish, so they happen to be Jewish. But it would play out, where would it make a difference that you have the Dafka Jewish king? That would be in the land of Israel. So in the land of Israel, there's the comment that the Ron makes, that source 7 over here. People love this Ron. You know, people who, you know, may not necessarily have been conversant in any other Ron in Maseches Nedarim, but people really seem to know this particular Ron, where the Ron says, he quotes a Tosfos, who says that this principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina, that the law of the land is considered to be the law, the binding law, especially when it comes to the right of the king to collect taxes, is Dafka Mamachi Obdi Kachavim. It's only with respect to non-Jewish kings, Amar the Dina de Malchusa Dina. Why is that? Because the land belongs to the king. Misha Aret Shelo. But the land of Israel, this land is, you know, your land, this land is my land. This land is the land of every single Jew, right? When it comes to the land of Israel, it doesn't belong to the king. We all have our Dalet Amos in Eretz Yisrael. So he says only with respect to non-Jewish kings, Misha Aret Shelo, it's his land. You can say, if you don't do my bidding and pay my taxes, I'm going to banish you from the land. I need you to pay taxes as what? As a form of rent. It's a form of rent for the right to live in my land and to receive the services that I provide in my land. About the Malka Yisrael, lo l'fisher Yisrael, lo, period, or comma. Malka Yisrael doesn't apply. L'fisher Eretz Yisrael, ko Yisrael shutrim ba, because we all belong to Eretz Yisrael. It belongs to all of us. So therefore, he says that it would only be applicable to a non-Jewish king in a non-Jewish land. So there were a number of people who wanted to say, great, so you have to maybe pay taxes if you live outside of Israel. But if you live in Israel, you certainly don't have to pay the taxes because they don't have no right to charge rent. So it could be that the Ron's model, that you have an obligation to charge rent, is a model that makes a lot of sense according to the Rambam, but it's not necessarily the exclusive model. We would say, Dina de Malchusa Dina, even in Eretz Yisrael, based on the Lashon of the Rambam. The Rambam says, Bein Shayamel Goy, Bein Shayamel Yisrael. So the Beis Yosef, says explicitly, in Siman Shin Samach Tes, in Chol Shemishpa, from the fact that the Rambam explicitly lists both a non-Jewish king and a Jewish king. So therefore, we see that even in Eretz Yisrael, we apply the principle of Dina de Malchus. And he brings another raya. If there really was a difference between Israel and outside of Israel, so when the Gemara was distinguishing between when you're obligated to pay the tax collector, the Gemara could have said, Kan be'Eretz Yisrael, Kan be'chutz le'Eretz Yisrael. In fact, Rav Avadya Yosef in his Yechav Adas, in Chela Kei of the Yechav Adas, Masim and Samach Dalet, he uses the same argument to demonstrate that whatever obligation there is pursuant to Dina de Malchusa to pay taxes applies whether you have an actual king or whether you have a kingdom. You have a government which is made up of ministers and a president and a cabinet and you have a presidium, whatever you have. Even if it's not an actual king, call it a president, a prime minister, a cabinet, a government, a legislature, whatever you have that is running the government is considered to be the same as a king, because if you would need Dafka, somebody who is a king, who has the power to put people to death for rebelling against the king, being a Morei B'Malchus, or that type of an authority, then the Gemara also could have distinguished and said, oh, Kan be Malchus Sheyesh Bo Melech, but the fact that the government, that the Gemara did not distinguish in that way shows that there is no real distinction. And Melech is a broad term. It could mean an actual king, it could mean a president, it could mean a parliament. It could just mean that there is a functional, legitimate government that is running the country. So how do you understand? On the one hand, the Rambam does talk about...
Might there be a difference between a representative government versus a king, a sovereign, that perhaps is a representative government? In a way, they're the shteach of all the citizens of the land.
Yes, if anything, there might be a different argument for the payment of the taxes. Because if you think about it, the idea of Dina de Malchusa is that a king has the right, like in Parshas HaMelech that we discussed, which is another source of Dina de Malchusa. We have one source, the Ran, who says the king can charge rent for the land, right? We have the other source that anything which is in Parshas HaMelech, the king has the right to do. You can say that that means that the king can say, give me money just to fatten my own pockets, and to glorify my own palace, even if you're not going to get a benefit from the money directly, that the king might have that right. If it's a representative government, so then you have more of an argument, actually, that maybe the tax is enforceable for a totally separate reason, and not just sort of your standard explanation of Dina de Malchusa. It could be because you have an obligation towards all of the other citizens that the government is basically a representation of all the citizens saying, we need money for ourselves. We need our money for our mail. We need money for our garbage collection. So when I first had heard Shiurim on the subject of tax collection and Dina de Malchusa for my Rebbe, Rav Shechter Shlita, going back, I don't know, 35 years ago or so, so he would start off by quoting the Ran's explanation, the explanation of Parshas HaMelech that you find in the Mi'ili and the Vilna Gaon. There's also the famous explanation of the Rashbam in Baba Basra, which I provided in the sources just to be yesterday's. That's source 8 over here, who says that what is the reason that you have to pay taxes? All of these taxes, Misim Banunia, said that the various tax. And the tolls that are imposed by the king. He says that this is the reason why it's binding, is because you have a social contract, not necessarily a representative government, but a social contract. They say, we need to have law and order. If we didn't have law and order, we didn't have a king, we didn't have some type of a governmental order, so then ishes reyeu chayim b'lo. Oh, everybody would just eat each other up like a bunch of fishes in the sea or whatever. Therefore, there is this social contract. So however the king apportions the money or decides to collect taxes, it's not going to be considered to be gezel, because the king has the right to enact monetary laws, and certainly, says the Rashbam, to collect taxes. So, you know, maybe we hold like the reason of the Ran, that the king has the right to collect rent, but even when that reason doesn't apply, we have all kinds of other reasons for Dina de Malchusa. So there were more explanations. You could use any of these as explanations as to why the king has the right to collect the tax. But in later years, my Rebbe, you know, Shlita Rav Shechter, I should say he's really, you know, a Rebbe of all of ours, you know, but certainly my own Rebbe from way back when, but Rav Shechter developed a new theory. He first wrote this up, I think, in the Shari Tzedek. I was going back and seeing where he wrote this up. He wrote this up in the Shari Tzedek journal in Chelik Vav. He wrote this up in the Shari Tzedek. Shari Tzedek is the journal that collects the proceedings of the annual International Dayonis Conference that I go to most years. He wrote up this essay in Chelik Vav of the journal, and he wrote it up in Chelik Dezayin of the journal, and then he wrote it up in his Sefer Ginas Egos, and then he wrote it up in an article in Torah Web, which was in English, so that's the one that I included in the materials, because it's the easiest to read, in which he argued more for a partnership model. He said that basically, independent of any of the other arguments of Dina de Malchusa, there is an obligation to pay taxes because you're stealing from everybody else in your representative government, when basically the imposition of taxes is not a king's decision, but it's a decision that we all make through our elected representatives, because it provides us with needed services, whether it be the military, whether it be the mail, or whether it be the garbage pickup. Therefore, if you don't pay your fair share, you're stealing from everybody else. Not necessarily you're stealing from the government. We're stealing from each other. if we're not paying the taxes. So that's the other explanation, but that applies to more to what you call a democratically elected representative government. Now, if you take a look in the Kesef Mishnah in source of 4 over here, so the Kesef Mishnah also kind of asks the question, and the fact that he asks the question is very, very telling. He says, okay, we have the sugya in Baba Kama, and we understand Rav Ashi gave this explanation. If I have a tax collector who's a non-Jew, so you don't have to pay the tax collector who's a non-Jew because of the fact that Havkas Havaasu is permissible when it comes to a non-Jew. So he says, but then I don't understand the conclusion of the Rambam. I have a Jewish tax collector. Where's the Jewish tax collector giving the money? The Jewish tax collector is going to give the money to the non-Jewish king. So ultimately, it's all coming from the non-Jewish king. So he says, look at the bold-faced type that I have in source for over here. Kesef Mishnah Hilchos Tzeilah Aveda Perikei Halacha Yid Aleph on the Rambam that we just read. It says, V'hashta, Kevan, the Havacha Min Hamechas Lo Havi, Ela Kafkas Hava Aso, since we are even not paying the taxes, is going to just be just a delinquency in terms of your obligation of what you owe the government. Am I also labriach min hamechas melech akum? Why, if I have a non-Jewish government, would it be forbidden for me to avoid paying taxes? So he gives an answer that not all of you are going to like. So what's the answer that he gives? This is the Kesef Mishnah. So the answers he gives kind of count a lot because it gives us insight into whatever he means when he codifies the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, right? B'shemei Yeshlama, Dahaka Shaini, Shemei Namelch Yisrael, Legabes Lochelko, Tavi, Tahave, Kiilo, Amelch Atzmo, Goveo, Dashtim, Obadshim, Yodei, Yeshkel, Hashem, Bedaber. He says that the problem is that when you have the Jewish representative is collecting the taxes, so the king is keeping track of it. So if you don't pay the Jewish representative, it's going to be a big chil Hashem. We just said you can't rely upon Avkos Havaso if it's going to be a desecration of God's name. And not only that, but it could be that it will lead to a pogrom. Efshar sheyiyeh sakonas nefashos bedaber. It might be sakonas nefashos as well. He says, but if it's the case of an akum who is simply paying the king, how does it work when I have the non-Jewish tax collector? The non-Jewish tax collector, he says, is that a case where the non-Jew gives over to the king, there's a stipulation. He has to give over the king whatever is the set amount, and whatever he's able to collect that is above that amount, he's going to be able to keep for himself. So the king is going to get his amount no matter what from the non-Jewish collector. So the non-Jewish collector doesn't know the Jewish community, so therefore it's not going to be known or reported or anything like that. There's no real accounting. So the non-Jewish tax collector, you don't have to pay him, and the king's not going to lose anything. So there's not going to be any sakanas nefashis. But otherwise, it's going to be a sakanas nefashis when you have the Jewish tax collector and it's known that he's kind of paying out of his own pocket and that the Jews are not actually giving him the money, word is going to come out. So it comes out, according to the Kesef Mishnah, that the question is better than the answer, meaning that there really is a dispensation of Havkas Havaso when it comes to paying taxes. The only reason you got to pay taxes, according to the Kesef Mishnah, is because otherwise it's going to be a chil Hashem, or it's going to be very dangerous to the Jewish community. If you could figure out a way to avoid paying your taxes, it's not going to be a chil Hashem, it's not going to be dangerous to the Jewish community, sounds like that's going to be A-OK, according to that explanation. So now, if you take a look at the Magid Mishnah...
Is that only when it's a king? I mean, nowadays we're not dealing with a tax collector, you're dealing with a representative of the government.
100%, it might be a totally different story. We're going to see that in just a moment, okay? So now, it's an excellent question. But let's take a look at the Magid Mishnah. We'll go a little bit in order over here. So the Magid Mishnah also asks the question, what is the case with a Mukas Akum? Why is it that you don't pay the non-Jewish tax collector? If the non-Jewish tax collector, let's say, he is legitimate, meaning that if I'm going to assume that the king, like the Rambam says, even a non-Jewish king, is entitled to his money, so who cares if it's a non-Jewish tax collector at the end of the day? The Magid Mishnah seems to have gotten the memo. What I mean, he's gotten the memo. He got the memo. This Rabbi Willig has an article in his Am Mordechai on Choshen Mishpat in which he alludes to this, that the Magid Mishnah seems to have understood that the Rambam could not possibly have accepted the explanation that Havkas Havaso is okay because the Rambam doesn't paskin that way. So if the Rambam doesn't hold that Havkas Havaso is okay, So what's the problem? Why wouldn't you have to pay Muchas Akum? Hafkasa, if you owe the money, so you're obligated to pay the money. So explains the Magen Mishnah, no. The Muchas Akum case, according to the Rambam, is very, very simple. That whenever I have a non-Jewish tax collector, I can assume that only shady people go into this line of work, and therefore, since I don't know him one way or another, I have the right. The Jewish fellow I know, but the non-Jewish fellow, I know him to be a Neman, but the non-Jew I don't know, so I have the right to assume, like the Chazakah, that he's a shady character and he's collecting more than he's entitled to collect, and therefore I don't have to pay him anything. That's the Magi. So the Magi Mishnah, the question of the Kesef Mishnah, doesn't get off the ground, because of course you have to pay the non-Jewish government. You have no heter. There is no dispensation of Afkas Halva also. Not with respect to the non-Jewish government that's collecting tax, and not with respect to the non-Jewish tax collector who's appointed either, unless there's a chazaka that he happens to be a Goslin. So Mishnah Lamela goes one step further, and he says, I want to understand what is the basis of what the Rambam says when the Rambam says, Ibneshu Gozel Menas HaMelech. He says, I have a different kasha on the Kesef Mishnah. Not just the kasha that, if it's Hafkas Havasu, it should be okay. If the reason that it's ultimately required to pay the government is because of the fact that otherwise it's going to be Sakanas Nefashos, or otherwise it's going to lead to a Chilul Hashem, so that does not stem with the language of what the Rambam said. But because if you take a look, this is about 7-8 lines down in the Mishnah Lamelech. He says about 8 words. This is the line that begins with the words Bamelech Kuti. Okay, so 6 lines down, Bamelech Kuti. About 10 words into the line, it says Avalapishi to say. According to the Kesef Mishnah, he says Afi Avalapishi to say Ein Daiti Noche B'Teirutzo. He says he does not like the Teretz Shetala Hadavar. The Rambam didn't say anything about Sakanas Nefashos. Right? If you take a look at the Rambam in source 3, he says you're obligated to pay taxes because otherwise, if you avoid paying taxes, if you're Mavriach Mimeches, Zem Ibnei Shugozel Menas HaMelech, then you're stealing directly. So he says therefore, the only explanation is as to why you don't pay the Mukas Akum is because the assumption is similar to the Magen Mishnah that he's collecting more than he's entitled to be collecting. But he says, well, let's say I don't have a Mukas Akum. Let's say I just have an apotropos. I don't have somebody who bought the tax concession, but I just have a representative of the government knock on my door and say, I'm here to collect the taxes. The IRS agent knocks on my door. I want to collect the taxes. He says, Aval, this is 3 lines, this is in the bold-faced type, the word mutter probably shouldn't have been bolded, but start with the next word. Aval, amabriach, minas ha-melech akum shlomako l'shumadam, ela shemina apotropos alav. He didn't have somebody buy the concession, he just has his tax collectors who work for the government, and they go from place to place collecting the money. Ein kan esek l'hafkas akum. There's nothing to do with hafkas havas, so he says, she'itivu b'gemara. He assumes, not like the Magen Mishnah, or not like our interpretation of the Magen Mishnah, that Hakara Hafkas Habaso is in fact Asr, even if it would be Mutter, he says it's not applicable when I'm dealing with the government. Kirin the Dina the Machus the Dina Vare Gazer Shle Yabicho Ameches Badayam Abriach. That's not only Hafkas Habaso, it's beyond that. It's considered to be Gozelu. It's considered to be Gezel Mamish, Bizebor. Now, why is it considered to be Gezel Mamish? So again, we have a few suggestions that we can throw in there. One suggestion is that it's Gezel Mamish because of the fact that, as the Ran says, that there is this rental obligation that you have, so you're stealing the property of the king. You're stealing the services that the king provides without paying for it. So that's considered to be outright Gezel. Who is it who makes that explanation? I'm sorry?
Is there a reason we're calling it Gezel as opposed to Gneva?
We're calling it Gezel as opposed to Gneva. That's a separate discussion. Geneva is considered to be stealthy. You know, here you're actually taking things. You're taking the land. You're living on the land. You're living off of the land, so it's open and notorious. So therefore, that would be Gezel under these circumstances, as opposed to something that you do, you know, in the dark of the night, which would be more Geneva. But it's an excellent topic, and maybe we'll devote a topic to that. The difference between Geneva and Gezel. It's a very, very fascinating subject. and I have what to say about it, so, you know, maybe for another time. So, if you take a look in the Shulchan Aruch HaRad, this is source 15 over here, source 15, so he says, I'm going to explain to you why this is Gezel Mamish. According to that approach, this is now the approach of the Mishnah LeMelech. I think we could read it into the Magid Mishnah as well, but he says, why is this considered to be Gezel? I mean, of course, the Magid Mishnah, you can say, Safkos Milvanim, that's Usr. But why would I say that it's Gezel Mamish? So he says like this, look at the second line in the Shulchan Aruch HaRad, this is the Baal HaTanya, in Hilkos Kzei L'Gneva Siftes Bav, second line, about halfway through, he says, Mipnei, that Shekola Aretz L'Melechu, because the entire king belongs, the entire land belongs to the king, he has the right to say you have no right to derive a pleasure or benefit from the land unless you pay your tax. You think it's about the fikach, end of the line, he violates those sigzo. Why does he violate those sigzo? Meaning she goes to us a melech, because he's actually stealing from the king, Bain Shehu Melech Yisrael, Bain Melech Nochmi. And that's, he says, even if I assume, like the Mishnah LeMelech seems to assume, that Havkas HaVa'aso is in fact Mutter, but She'af, look at the next line, it's beautiful. She'af She'mutter La'kiya Chobu She'chayim Menachri, even if I assume Havkas HaVa'aso is going to be permitted, that's when I'm dealing with an individual Nachri to whom I owe money, okay? She'chayim Menachri Mechbar Zeh, Eno K'mavkiya Chobu, but this isn't a Mavkiya Chobu, and the Gozo Mamish, what's the Gozo Mamish? You take a look, Moshe, it says, She'nene Me'artso Shalom Midaita, because he's getting direct, open and notorious benefit from his land against his will. And he's losing, and he's causing him to lose direct money because somebody else could be living in this land and paying the taxes for living on the land, right? So the right that you have to conduct business in the king's land could be enjoyed by somebody else who will pay the taxes. So I'm enjoying the fruit of the land, I'm enjoying being able to make money in the land, and I'm not paying my fair share of that, so then I'm stealing something from the king. It's outright theft.
Separate, though, the fact that I'm allowed to do this is only because the king allowed me to do it. I don't have an inherent right, according to most.
But I only have the right to do it if I'm going to pay taxes. That's right. The understanding. Exactly. And then he brings the social contract argument as well. And he works this into the social contract argument. Everybody agreed to this. Everybody agreed that they're going to serve the king in this fashion. And there's a certain lien that the king has on them and their work and their property. So every piece of business, every piece of property and asset that comes into your possession, the king already has a lien on them. He already has a right on to them. He already on some level belongs to him. It's considered like it's already in his rishus, and I'm taking something which was already in his rishus, right? It goes as a chanis miyad mitzri on some level. Kivin shu be'artzo, be'etzo, abdo, be'amabicha, goes in as a melech, shibam rishus a melech. This came from the rishus a melech, and I'm actually stealing it. And then he does say, look, there's another approach. He's very honest. You know, he says there's another. Who would be the other approach? The other approach would obviously be, we saw the Kesef Mishnah. This is why it's important to be medayek very carefully in the words over here. It's a very nuanced sugya, but, you know, if you read with a careful nuance, there are huge nafkaminas, you know, the dina. I could sit here and just say, yeah, we enjoy the, you know, the boot of the government, therefore you have to pay taxes, and it's the right thing to do, and end the shiur right there. But it's important to understand the different shitos and where everybody's coming from, and how it all emerges from the sugyas in the Gemara. So he brings v'yesh chokin azeh, umatim l'avriach hameches, who actually permit you to avoid paying taxes, even if you actually had a Jew who would be collecting the taxes, kimin shigovel melech nakli, because you're collecting for a non-Jewish king. Who said that? That was basically the Kesef Mishnah, who said the only reason you'd have to pay is because of Chil Hashem or Sakana. And it's only if you're afraid of Sakana that you would have to pay. But what is the appropriate approach that he says that you should follow? He says he favors the first svara, because otherwise you're going to be violating a los asa shibatara of los idzo. He says this isn't some chumrah on a derabbanan level. This is a real issa de araisa if you're potentially, if you're not going to end up paying the taxes. So how does it end up getting codified in the Shulchan Aruch? So it's very interesting. In the Shulchan Aruch, you have basically a difference of opinion, it seems, between the Mechaber and the Ramah. The Ramah seems to take a stricter view, but obviously the starting point is you're obligated to pay taxes, unless I'm dealing with a tax collector who's an Oviko Chavim, a tax collector who is self-appointed, a tax collector who Eimo Kitzvah, who's collecting more than his fair share. The Shulchan Aruch has a very interesting lashon over here, where just as almost, you know, an important part of the discussion that I want to just focus on for a moment is, are we talking about, you know, all kinds of taxes over here? We said that Rav Elbel Soloveitchik was of the opinion that we say, Dina de Malchusa, Dina Benacham Senusa de Malchusa, not if it's an unfair government. So what's an unfair government? Where they just tax people indiscriminately. They say, we don't like you, so we're going to make you pay a lot of money, but somebody else, we're not going to make pay anything. And you just have like a government which could be compared to Sodom, where there were laws, but the laws were discriminatory and they were unjust, so that's not considered to be a just government. Nowadays, you could apply that to Nazi Germany and the Nuremberg laws, which would not be like a real, fair, or legitimate government for taxation purposes either. But the Shulchan Aruch explicitly says that even if certain populations, ethnic populations, let's say Jewish population arrived in the country and they weren't native to the country, they weren't endemic to the country, so the country says, we're opening up our doors, right? You know, and we're going to allow you to live in our country, but we're going to require you to pay higher taxes. Maybe for the first 50 years, 100 years, or whatever, we're going to require you to pay higher taxes. So the Ramah over here quotes a Ma'arik, "Vafilut siva shisra yiten yotem miyovik acharim mikol makom mikvi davar katzuv lecholish." As long as it's a set amount, and presumably it has some sort of a basis because they were immigrants and they're therefore they are going to be taxed at a higher rate, that would also be considered to be a legitimate tax. It's an interesting thing because it's a kasha on this a little bit from what the Shulchan Aruch says a little bit later on in Sifches. If you move to source 28, in source 28, it says Hagav, that's the Ramah, and then there's no space missing. So it says Ve'im Amel Chakok Lebal Umnus Echad. If the king imposed more of a tax on one profession, presumably this is already completely arbitrary and capricious, because we're dealing with one profession where the people have the same claim to the government and to the land, the same claim to do commerce within the governed area as anybody else, but maybe they're just making more money or that they're just being discriminated against because of their profession.
Oil windfall taxes
is a good example. However, if it's not fairly apportioned amongst all of the professions, so then you're going to say to the Jews, we're not taxing you more money because you're immigrants, but we're taxing you more money because you happen to be making, you know, more, so we're going to therefore impose more of a tax upon you because we think that your profession is one that we consider to be seedy or shady. We wouldn't do it ourselves, whatever their reasoning is. But it's not like a progressive tax per se. They're not going to impose this upon their rich barons who are making lots of money off of the Jews. It's just a particular profession that they're picking upon. So then he says, we might not say Dina de Malchus in that case. But if it's a progressive tax, so there's an essay, this is quoted by Rosh Schechter, it's an essay by Rosh Shlomo Yosef Levin, the famous, Zevin, excuse me, not Levin, Rav Zevin, I wrote a Lamin by mistake, Rav Zevin in his Sefer L'Torah U'Mo'adim, so he brings a raya. It's funny because when I was doing Mishnayos at one point in time over the past couple of years, I was doing Mishnayos Peah, so this actually occurred to me as I was doing Mishnayos Peah, but then I found that he says this explicitly, so I'll say, but I can't take credit because I never said it or wrote it down, so who knows, like, you know, if it was real when it went through my head, but I think it went through my head, that he brought a raya from the Mishnah in Peah that a progressive tax, in the sense that as people make more money, you can charge them not just more money in the sense that everybody gets taxed 20%, so 20% will go further if you're making more money than if you're making less money. But if somebody's making more money, you could charge them 30% or 35% based on the fact that they go into higher and higher tax brackets as they make more money. So he says, people think this is a taglis, it's an innovation, but he says, be'emes, Zoe, and he gives a whole nice description of a progressive tax, how it works in the first paragraph over here, which is in very simple and nice Hebrew. It should be, you know, introduced in any tax class on the subject from people who know basic Hebrew. It's written very nicely. But then afterwards he says, the Emes Zohi Mishnah Mefureshes. He says that this is an explicit Mishnah in Peah. Because what does it say in the Mishnah in Peah? That's the Mishnah that I was referring to. Ein Pokes in the Peah Mishishim, meaning Echem Mishishim. Everybody, no matter how poor how simple they might live, if they have a field, then they have to give at least 1/60 of the crops of their field as a charity payment to the poor. That's called leaving a quarter of their field a payer, right? There's no explicit amount of measurement you have to give for pay. I mean, give it like a tiny little bit. You give a couple of celery sticks, it's going to be enough. He says, Hakol lefi goldel hasodah. He says that mitrabanan, we apply this principle that it all depends on how much crops your field yields. And I'm a forshim shalom lam lefi godel asadeh. What does it mean lefi godel asadeh? Why don't you just say everybody gives 1/60? And if you have a big field, 1/60 will be a lot more than if you have a small field, right? Harayim said there gedolim melechem yishivshim shalom yuhabe yotem isadeh katana, right? So he says if you look at the meforshim, you actually have to look a little bit hard to find the Mephoreshim who say, they say other things, but they say this too. Avad ve'em es deli kolon shel masa progressivi. He says this is how the progressive tax works. That what they really mean, what this Mishnah really means, is the masada gedoli yoter ein echon mishishim maspik. 1/60 is not enough, but sarach liten yoter mi'echon mishishim. The funny thing is that they actually, to the extent that you have Mephoreshim who derive this from the Mishnah, they actually derive it more from the wording at the very end of the Mishnah, which is lefi rov ha'anova. Rov ha'anova sounds like modesty, but it also could be anova with a base, like, you know, how many grapes you have, and has other meanings as well, that you have oyunuvin miseva, that it means that you, if you are more productive and you have a more fruitful type of and a more exorbitant crop, so then you give according to the exorbitance of your crop. And I'll just quote, I found the best one who explains or expresses this idea clearly along the lines of Rav Zevin was the Kahati, so therefore I quoted from the Perush HaKahati, or Pinchas Kahati, says, V'kavana sadvarim, shemis barcheu sadeu, that if you had a very, shemis barcheu sadeu, you had a very good year, you had a very good crop, even though there aren't necessarily so many poor people to give to, you should give a higher amount, a higher percentage of your crops, yosi bashir, shir means a higher percentage, hapeyam, v'yitei ma'aniyam b'yad v'chavek, kivirkas Hashem eshenasamo, according to the blessing of your bounty, so therefore a progressive tax is not necessarily a problem. Some people might say, oh, look, the Shulchan Aruch said if you're going to tax the money lenders more than other people, so that doesn't count. So maybe a progressive tax also is considered to be discriminatory. So Rabbi Zevin points out that in our tradition, there is a basis, at least for a progressive tax. But what is the type of tax that people don't necessarily pay? It's like a sales tax that people aren't necessarily so careful about paying. They will go to New Jersey to buy where they don't have a sales tax, they don't have to pay sales tax, and they bring this stuff home, wherever they live, in New York, Chicago, wherever it is, and they don't end up paying sales tax. And sometimes it's because the person who sold it to you didn't have to sell you sales tax because it was in a state where they didn't charge sales tax. So really, you're supposed to fill in your tax returns all of the stuff that you bought.
Did you buy something in a state
that didn't charge you sales tax? And then you have to figure out how much. And if you can't figure out how much, they give you a formula that you're even allowed to estimate a certain amount, and you pay according to that estimation. And let's say that you just don't declare it. And let's say that most people don't declare. You come to that determination. Or you hire a housekeeper, and the housekeeper is an illegal immigrant, and maybe you're not supposed to hire an illegal immigrant because they are not subjected to, they're not really supposed to work, and it's very difficult. How do you even take out Social Security taxes to somebody who's not supposed to work altogether? I spoke to a tax partner at one of the major New York law firms about this, and they said, well, really, on some level, it's probably better to hire an illegal immigrant because the government doesn't really care so much about that. They're not going to get you into trouble for that unless you're planning to eventually be appointed as Attorney General, be appointed as a Supreme Court Justice. But otherwise, it's not going to necessarily get you into trouble. I remember I had a friend who said that he was thinking that one day he might want to be a cabinet official, and that's why he was very careful about this. But otherwise, he was a big part of it, a big law firm, and otherwise, he really wouldn't be so careful about it, wouldn't advise other people to be careful about it. But even when people are legal, and do have the right to work in this country. There are a lot of people who aren't so careful about paying them. I know that I was just talking to my wife the other day. We were filling in our taxes. I said, are we careful about, you know, paying the Social Security taxes for our workers? I remember it was something that we've been conscientious about in the past. That we have somebody who started working for us. And I said, there's not something, you know, that maybe we didn't focus upon. So is there a notion that if it's the sort of thing, you're not lying outright because you're not saying that you did hire such a person, you're just not filling in the information, and nobody really fills in the information. So it's a very fascinating thing.
You are
that,
testing on the form.
I don't know exactly. It depends what you're attesting to on the form, right? Or maybe you're not attesting to anything. Maybe your tariff accountant is just sending it in and you never actually like do anything. But the Minchas Asher, Rav Asher Weiss, so he has a couple of essays about Dina de Mahusa. So one essay, he says that he believes that basically the main premise of Dina de Mahusa is simply that there is a Dina Mahus. That if you look in the Torah, whether I'm learning it from Parshas to Melech, whether it's from the principle of Melech Mishpat Yamid Eretz, there is a sort of a, which is a pasuk in Mishlei, that there is a sort of this notion that the world couldn't function without a malchus, and it's on that basis. Once you have a malchus, of course, there's an understanding that they have the right to enact certain laws and taxes and so forth. But then, he talks about parameters of Dina de Malchus, so he has this very funny thing. He says that even though there is Dina de Malchus, I'll tell you one major difference between Dina de Malchus. I see we're reaching the end over here. It could be we're going to have a part two about this next week, but that's okay. So it says that one thing about Dina de Malchusa is that it's different from a Dina Torah in the following way. Dina Torah, it doesn't matter whether in a particular situation a certain mitzvah doesn't seem to make sense to you. We have a principle of Ein Chokma Ve'ein Eitzah Ve'ein Tfuna Neged Hashem. There's no room for pshaos. There's no room to make compromises. Oh, in this particular situation, I don't have to make a block on the food because I'm in a big rush and I don't think Hashem will care. No, there's no compromises when it comes to the performance of the mitzvahs. But when he says, but Dina de Malchusa, he says, this is all dependent upon what's important to the government. Sometimes they don't carve out exceptions for things because it would be too complicated for them to do so. And he gives an example. This is a terrible example. If he doesn't mind my saying so. Legavi Chukei Atnua, when he says we have like speed limits. Or you can't go through a red light. He says, come on. Although you do a day, everyone knows you can't go through a red light. Yeah, right. It's the middle of the night. And you see that there's no other car around. And there's no sakana. And nobody sees what you're doing. I mean, they might have a camera, actually. And nobody is going to learn from what you're doing. Not the slightest chance. Are you really going to tell me, according to the Torah, you can't go through the red light? Come on. Even the one who designed the law, they would be okay with you going through this red light. They just can't have the middle of the night exception when nobody's around. So he says, in all these situations, you have to take there's no sakana. You don't have to worry about dina de malchus in this case. So I think that example is a terrible example, because if you're going to be lax in that case, it probably will lead to a sakana. So you should never, that's sort of a good example of where something was probably intended as a low plug, where people shouldn't make their own judgments about when to go through red lights, my goodness. But certainly when it comes to jaywalking, my principle has always been that if you would be comfortable doing it in front of the police officer and you would wave and say good morning, you would say good morning back, and not caring the least that you're jaywalking. Now, so they do care. But here, where in many places they really could not care less about the jaywalking, so then maybe this principle that he applies at the end really is an applicable principle. If you know they don't care, so it's not an absolute rule like the Dina Torah. Maybe it wouldn't be applicable. Even though technically speaking it's against the Chok. So it could be that with respect to certain things that nobody pays or bothers to pay, and maybe the IRS wouldn't care, so maybe that would be okay. But I'm very dubious as to whether there's anything that the IRS really wouldn't care about, so I'm not sure exactly how much to apply that. Plus, once we talk about the partnership model, as opposed to the Dina de Malchusa model, then the whole thing falls off, because the fact that for purposes of the partnership model, you need to pay the full amount in order to not to be stealing from everybody else in terms of the services that are provided. We're going to continue. Next.
Can you clarify the thing you said about somebody who was paying you? Because in most cases, the person that's paying you is not the owner.
In terms of what?
If you go to a store and they give you the wrong change, that person is not the owner.
No, but they're a representative of the owner. They're a representative of the owner. Now, we're going to